Anyway, I think I have the right one loaded now, and we'll get started. I realized something about myself this week, actually. I probably shouldn't say realized, more of remembered or acknowledged, I guess. I was thinking about the Red Letter series and how we did that, and was kind of thinking about how that was comparing with how things were going with this particular series. And I've always been quite inquisitive. I ask a lot of questions. In fact, the lion's share of the messages that I've given have come from studies that I've done in me just asking questions, like, where did this doctrine come from, or that doctrine, and what happens when you die, and, you know, do we have an immortal soul apart from God, and just things like that. And so what ends up happening then is most, probably, I probably shouldn't say all, but the lion's share of the messages end up being topical in nature. And I read the Bible that way, topically most of the time. I forced myself a few years ago to read the Bible through chronologically, not in the order of the books as you see them, but in chronologically in time, because I realized I'd never done that, and I didn't really have a grasp on that timeline in that way. There's teachers out there that teach in an expository nature. They'll take verse 1 and explain that, and then they'll go to verse 2 and explain that, and on and on. And, you know, in that way, the Red Letter series would have been right up their alley, right? Just going from one things to the next. But as I thought about that, I realized that even in the Red Letter series, I didn't do that even when I had the chance to do it. I would sit down and I would read those words, and then I would think about the topic that those words were applicable to, and that's what I would run with for the message. That's just my stripes, I guess. Can't change it. So really what should be done is I really need to go back through the whole Red Letter series. And instead of putting on the website Red Letters Part 1, Red Letters Part 2, Red Letters Part 25, you know, there probably should be some, because that didn't tell you anything. You know, you don't know what you're going to listen to. You don't know. So I probably need to go back there and redo those titles, I guess. But do that in my spare time, right? Maybe somebody will be inspired to take that task. Anyway, that made me wonder about how this series will play out, and I guess we'll find out together. But today, though, we're right on the same pattern. The words of Yehovah this week led me right to a topical subject. We're going to jump forward today to chapter 11 of Genesis and get Yehovah's next words. We'll begin in verse 1 and we'll read down through verse 9. Now the whole world had one language and one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Okay. So obviously, our topic today is the Tower of Babel. centered, of course, on, you know, God's words that he spoke concerning it, these words. There's some interesting revelations and insights to gain here. But I think in order to do that, we really need to set the stage. We need the where. Where is this? And we need the who. Who is this referring to? And when we have that, then maybe we can understand the why. And if we get the why, then we can understand how it might apply to us or relate to us today, which is really what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to read the words of God and pull out what God is saying to us. So that's my approach today. Sound good? Let's get started quickly with the where. We read that they were in a plain in the land of Shinar. Okay, so where is that? And why does it even matter? Well, you're going to see it does matter. We'll find out more information about this land and what was there if we roll back to chapter 10 and verse 10, where it says, "And the beginning of his kingdom," we're going to come back to this a bit later and get some more context, but for right now, "the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar." So this tells us that there were these cities. There were four cities in the land of Shinar. And so for perspective, if you'll recall back in the World Watch series, I showed you this area here on the map. This is a map of that area and the cities that were contained within that area. And this comes from about the second millennium BC. This is in the time of Zechariah. And, you know, the cities listed in Genesis that we read were conquered. They were controlled by various people from that time to the time of Zechariah. But we can track that, right? So we know that some of these cities are the same cities. Some now just with different names, but the same as those that we just read. Now here is a current map showing where those cities are today. Right there on the border of Iraq and Iran, and most of it, of course, being in Iran, or Iran, whatever. And so, you know, hopefully that gives you a little bit of perspective. And it's important because this land has tremendous impact on prophecy and all of the prophetic implications that we talked about in various times, especially during the World Watch series. Why? Because really one of the major themes of the Bible is the prophetic implications of this battle, so to speak, between God and his city, Jerusalem, and Israel, and Satan and his city, or structure, his nation of Babylon. It's this contextual, you know, conflict between Israel and Babylon, between Jerusalem and Babel. Okay? Notice that Babylon is right there. See, in the center. You see it right there? Right there. There's Babylon, right in the land of Shinar. Okay. Jerusalem and Babylon are a key to understanding Bible prophecy. So what does Babylon have to do with Babel? Well, let's go back to verse 9. "Therefore, its name is called Babel because there the Lord confused the language." That's your hint. Because we read that the name of the city that the tower was built in was called Babel because of something. Because the Lord confused the language there. So that's why it's called Babel. Okay? And Babel simply means confusion in Hebrew. And it's also the root word of Babylon. So they are kind of one and the same. Babel is Babylon in that sense, or should I probably say Babel is in Babylon, okay? The way I understand it, in my view, Babel was one of the cities within the land of Shinar, which was the area of Babylon, because Babylon had more than one city, Babel being one of them. That's how I see it. That's how I explain it. If that's wrong, it doesn't really matter to our point today, because we understand completely that the tower was indeed part of Babylon. It was in that area, in the land or area of Shinar, which, as we saw, is today what would be eastern Iraq and western Iran. All right, so that's the where. That really starts to get interesting when you get into the who. Okay, we need to know who God is reacting to. He's not talking to them. He's reacting to what's going on with these people. He refers to the people. He says they. He's going to confuse their language, right? So who is he talking about? Well, we don't have to guess. We just have to flip back one chapter again to chapter 10. Chapter 10, remember, is giving the genealogy of the sons of Noah. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the three sons of Noah that came off the ark. And for context, you need to remember the story of Noah and how he, planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and he got drunk, and there was some shenanigans going on there, and he was naked in his bed. And if you remember, Shem and Japheth took a cloth and backed up into the tent and covered Noah's nakedness. Ham and his son Canaan were complicit in the whole thing. We'll just leave it at that. And Noah ended up cursing them, cursing Ham and his son Canaan. And so with that, we'll go back to chapter 10, and we'll find there the explanation of the people, because we're trying to find out who God is dealing with here. We're going to see the people that settled in the land of Shinar. It says, the sons of Ham, Noah's son, were Cush, and then two other sons, and Canaan. So Ham and Canaan were the ones that Noah cursed, specifically Canaan. Now Cush then begot Nimrod. Here's Nimrod. He began to be mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it was said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And he wasn't hunting just animals, people. He was a murderer. Okay. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. That's the verse we read a moment ago. So hopefully, I've talked about enough of this stuff with you in the past that this is kind of coming together for you who these people are. Nimrod was later deified by the pagans. The Bible refers to him as Baal, okay? And as that pagan religion spread across the globe over time, many other names were applied to that god, okay? But it began right here after the flood. Nimrod literally means he rebelled. That's what the name means in Hebrew. Just like Satan rebelled. Baal worship is Satan worship. Satan's religion of rebellion, if you will. So here at Babel, we are seeing the place and the people that are literally the beginning of the post-flood paganism. Baal worship, Babylon, and all that entails in scriptures. So you have the where, and now you're seeing the who these people are. Descendants of Ham and Canaan, led by Nimrod, their king. They are rebels against God in the land of Babylon. Now, some tend to think, due to the wording of verse 1, that the whole earth had one language and one speech, that that would mean that all the people of the earth were there in the land of Shinar, everybody. I don't think it says that, and I don't think it doesn't say that. You know, it just merely says that all the earth had one language, and then it begins to refer to they as those that are dwelling in the land of Shinar. The Bible defines who they are, as we've seen. We saw it was the descendants of Ham and Canaan. All right. So, you know, I guess there again, it wouldn't necessarily mean that only the descendants of Ham and Canaan were there. I'm not being dogmatic. I'm only trying to point out that the descendants of Ham and Canaan were there. That is biblically done, and they were led by Nimrod. And Nimrod was against God. He was being led by Satan and being, as we said, the incubator of the post-flood paganism. God here was not reacting to God-fearing people wanting to build a thing all the way up into the sky to heaven to be with God. That's not what was going on here. What he was reacting to, what God is doing, is reacting to rebellion. These people were engaged in idolatrous false worship. They were trying to ascend to God in a way that was not ordained. We know, don't we, that there is only one way, all right, to the Father, and that is through Yeshua. There's only one door, and they're trying to make this other door, okay? So the who is important as we begin to unpack the why. Why did God do what he did? What's that mean for us today? Because indeed, Bible prophecy tells us that we are living in Babylon today. So this is important. It's relevant to us now. So with the where and the who established, let's begin to unpack this a little bit. There's a lot of hints here and indications of what's going on. Obviously, they were making some building materials. They had their bricks in verse 3 to do their project. And it says they want to build a city. And they want to build a tower. Notice the intent of why they wanted to build those things. In verse 4, it says that they wanted the top of it to be in the heavens. Or, you know, that's implying maybe the throne. Okay, now think about that. Now you know who Nimrod is. You know Satan is guiding him, using him to birth his religion. But what does Satan want? He wants to be God. He wants to rule. In his vanity, he wants worship. But he's not a creator. He's a counterfeiter. He doesn't have any unique ideas most of the time. I'll tell you what, technology today is not our friend. Get this back up there, hopefully. Yeah, he's not. He always just wants to just copy and counterfeit what God is doing, and so he was cast to the earth for his rebellion. What in the world is going on? I don't know, guys. I just don't know today. Bear with me. This is ridiculous. None of it's coming up, is it? No. And then you completely lose your train of thought. I wouldn't mess with this just for the scriptures, but I've actually got some images that I want to show you here in a minute, so it's a little bit important that I get this back up here. Is it back up? Yeah, okay. All right. So anyway, you know, Satan, we know that he tried to, you know, go to the throne and take over the throne and his rebellion. That's what he thinks of himself. So he's demonstrated that he wants to penetrate heaven, right? But God has set up this divide right now. There is a divide between heaven and earth, okay? Now the new heaven and the new earth, we won't have that divide. The throne will come here, you know, they'll be together. But right now there is a divide. And it seems like, you know, Satan continually wants to violate that division. I mean, he likes violating anything God puts forward. God sits in heaven and he says, that's good. He puts man on earth and he says, that's good. Okay? And then it just seems like all Satan wants to do is violate that. Okay? We saw it in Genesis 6 when the sons of God went in, saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and came into them. He's violating, you know, this. And so we see a violation here that he is trying to guide people to think that there's another way, right, to heaven, that there's another way to life, to God. And it's just not correct. I mean, he's trying to create a counterfeit throne that he can sit on. And it's an abomination to God. And so he's dealing with it. He's reacting to it. And so when we look at this story, you know, the tower always gets the spotlight, right? It gets a lot of press, as they say. Some say it was some special technology that, you know, we would know nothing about, that could have been a weapon or a power source or something that if it wasn't destroyed, you know, it would have damaged the earth, like a nuclear reactor or something that went awry, you know, a huge Chernobyl or something. I've also read that it was like the pyramids. I've read people and talked to people that thought that there was power that was generated in there that would create a beam up through the center of the pyramid, that if you stepped into that beam, it would transport you to heaven. I mean, I'm serious. You get all kinds of things. It's some I, you know, I was doing some reading and seriously, people were liking it to the Stargate of SG-1. Have you ever watched that show, Stargate SG-1? Where they went from world to world through this ancient Stargate. Only they say what the Stargate was doing was taking you to the throne, taking you to heaven. Right? So, I don't know what would happen if you actually were physical and you left a physical earth, what's going to happen to you? I don't know if they thought about that, but it's pretty sketchy if you ask me. All this, of course, is pure speculation, has no root in any evidence whatsoever. But there has been some evidence that has cropped up from archaeology of what the Tower of Babel might have looked like. They found this stone actually in the land of Shinar. And the etchings on it are, you know, drawing this tower, and the writing on the bottom of the stone actually describes the tower and all of that. And if you look closely, you'll be able to see, you're not supposed to be able to see that yet. Anyway. This is covering that up, but on the other side of that tablet, there was actually etchings, an image of the Babylonian king. So you had the tower and the image of the king there that built this tower, and when you look at the writings on there and the description of it, this is the illustration that they give of what, according to this stone, the tower would have looked like. And there's a lot written. If you'll notice, there's seven layers, seven deals going up that tower. And when you look into paganism, various pagan religions around the world to this day, they talk about the seven levels of heaven. Okay? And here this tower, what did the Bible say? That they were trying to ascend unto heaven. And here is a building representing the seven layers of heaven. So it does dovetail pretty good, because I doubt they were really believing they could build, you know, a tower that would go all the way up there. I think it was much more likely, based on this archaeological find, that it was symbolic, that it was probably like a temple. It's idolatry. And God needed to slow this down, okay? So, moving on, regardless of what the tower was and what its intended use was, I think it was a pagan temple. We have enough in Scripture to understand who these people were and why God did what He did. We're going to go back to verse 4. Notice it carefully. What did they want to do with the bricks other than the tower, and why? They wanted to build a city. They wanted to make a name for themselves. And they didn't want to be scattered over the face of the earth. That's what it says. We want a city, we want a name for ourselves, and we don't want to be scattered. But let's talk first about them wanting to make a name for themselves. Remember who's leading them. Nimrod, meaning he rebelled, just like Satan did. In this ancient act of rebellion, men were tired of being named. Names back then referred to who they were and what their identity was, okay? Like Nimrod, it's a rebel. And so these were descendants of Ham and Canaan, cursed by Noah, named in that sense, to be servants of the other two brothers. They wanted to create a new name for themselves. They wanted to create their own identity. They wanted to define themselves. In a broader sense, beyond just the curse of Noah, they were rebelling against who God proclaimed them to be, their station. They rebelled against the restrictions that God had placed on them in His law. Does that sound remotely familiar? Satan also had restrictions that he, you know, got for his rebellion, remember, to be confined to the earth. You know, in Genesis we read that you know, God told him, on your belly you shall go and you shall eat dust all, you know, of the earth. Satan was confined to the earth for his rebellion. Satan doesn't like his sins, and he's inspiring people to rebel against theirs as well. Go beyond where God says you can go, Satan says. Build a tower. Symbolic or otherwise, doesn't matter. Ascend. Overcome. Make a name for yourselves above that which God has ordained. Who is He to tell you what to do, who you are, how to live? You see? They wanted to create themselves to make themselves in the image that they wanted. See, eat of this fruit, and then you can decide right from wrong. It's the same message. This is not saying, you know, to be popular or famous for their building skill. They are wanting millions and millions of followers on Instagram and Facebook and to be in a magazine. That's not what they meant when they were saying, I want to make a name for myself to be famous. They wanted independence from God. They wanted to make themselves, not in God's image, but in the image of their own desire, their own name, their own identity. They decide their fate. It's pure rebellion. We see that today in agnostics and atheists that don't need God. They make their own name, don't they? An identity apart from God. All they need is their pseudoscience and billions of years to accomplish it. That's their tower, people. It's a tower. And God's going to knock that one down too. There's more rebellion revealed here as well. What were these people told by God to do? We read it last week. be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. And so what do? We have Ham at Babel completely rejecting God's instructions to fill the earth. Rather, they decide not to move out at all and fill the earth, but to stay together and let's build a city. Let's make a name for ourselves to not do what God instructed and instead stay together and do their own thing. Think of the temptation that's in that deception. See, in a city, man makes his own laws. He creates his own environment. In the city, man manufactures his own rights. He creates new rights with his laws. Not just for himself, he creates new entities in the city that can really only operate in the city. Entities like corporations and governing bodies and courts and other things that, and then he gives them rights. See, in the city, man is all powerful. Man is sovereign in the city with a name. And he doesn't need God. He has all he needs right there. At least he thinks he does. And it's very alluring. In Babel, they didn't want to be scattered out across the face of the earth. They did not want to fill the earth and multiply, right? He said the same thing to them that he said to Adam, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. But here we see the rebels saying, no, we don't want to fill the earth. We don't want to be scattered. That's what they said, lest we be scattered. We don't want to rely on God for everything and living His way. We want to make a name and a city. We want to create our own society, our own laws. We want to come together and build a city. We'll create our own identity, our own name. And if you try to restrict us, we'll build a tower. You said that heaven is where the throne is? Well, we'll build our own. You see? And then we can rule. Heaven rules us? All right, we'll make it. We'll make one. We'll reproduce it right here. We're men. We got bricks. And it'll happen right on level 7. And then we'll make all of these rules that allow people to move up and ascend. We don't need God. See, when you drill down on this, when you really begin to soak on what was going on here, you see the arrogance. You see the willful disregard for the sovereignty of the Almighty God. And the very first, who's leading all this? A murderer. Nimrod. Led by the spirit of Satan that invented willful disregard for God's ways. So Nimrod too flees the presence of God, turns his back on him, and he's a rebel. So with all that then, you can really begin to understand God's reaction to this. Let's read God's words again now. Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. This is what they do with it. Now nothing they propose to do will be withheld from them, so what are we going to do? Let's act. Let's confuse their language so that they are spread apart. The city stops being built, and they disperse. Which is, by the way, precisely what God told them to do in the first place. I don't know when men are ever going to learn that what God says goes, and you're either going to do it on your own volition, or you're going to do it later, the either way or the hard way. All right, the city didn't just stop getting built. I found this week. It's extra biblical writing, but it indicates that God totally destroyed the tower as well. It's in the book Theophilus to Autolycus, and we read this. When are fulfilled the threats of the great God with which he threatened men when formerly in the Assyrian land they built a tower, and all were of one speech and wished to rise even till they climbed into heaven? Then the immortal raised a mighty wind and laid upon them strong necessity. For when the wind threw down the mighty tower, then rose among mankind fierce strife and hate. One speech was changed to many dialects, and the earth was filled with diverse tribes and kings. So according to Theophilus, God put a stop to this level of rebellion, not just with the confusion of the language, but he destroyed the tower. You know, he knew that left unabated, man would get into all sorts of mischief. Notice again here, nothing they propose to do will be withheld from them. They would have gotten quickly right back into the same manner of violence and evil that they had right before the flood. This statement is also, in a way, kind of encouraging, you know. Because men have the capacity for great things, but not when it's applied in rebellion to God. Once the nature of man is healed, God will restore pure language again. He showed us that on the day of Pentecost, didn't he? At Babel, tongues were confused by God, but on Pentecost, God put aside the confusion of language, and it's a sign of what's to come. But for now, men still strive to build the city, don't they? Modern man is driven to finish the building of Babel. It's his desire to build a global Babel. We strive today for global unity, for global government. We hear all the time about the global economy. Man's nature hasn't changed. We want a city, and we want it our way. Our laws, our rules, our rights as we see them, as we decide what they are. A woman's right over her own body. A person's right to choose their sex, to make a name for themselves. You address me at the gender of my choosing. I'm not a he today, I'm a she, and you address me that way. That's my name, that's my identity, that's my name. To create themselves after all, because there is no creator in their mind. They're just an accident of lightning striking some primordial glue, goo, and then, you know, billions of years. This is what we saw in the Tower of Babel story, rebelling against the Creator God. Now, had they spread apart, still talking about cities here, and obeyed God, he didn't have a problem with them building cities. After all, God is in the process of building his city, isn't he? Here again, we see Satan without any unique ideas. He just counterfeits them. Well, God's going to build a city, I'll build a city. So God doesn't have a problem with cities. He has a problem with fallen men governing the cities and deciding the laws and all of that. Okay? Next week, we'll see God calling a man out of the city. Okay? Out of this mess, to get him out of this country so that he can begin to build the city and the nation of Israel. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so stay tuned for next week. Back to Babel. They should have dispersed, okay, and done what God told them to do. They should have obeyed God and gone out and filled the earth. But in their rebellion, they didn't do that, so they were forced to do it. God will have his way. Okay, his will be done on this earth as it is in heaven. So the desire for the city is not totally wrong. It was wrong for them at that time because the whole purpose of this city was to defy God and his law. We look forward to a city that's ruled in righteousness with God at the helm. And I can promise you that city's going to be nothing like this one or nothing like any of the cities that man has made. Because what we have today are perverted and counterfeit versions of Jerusalem. The very first time we see the Israelites, what were they doing? They were building a city. They were building a city for Pharaoh, right? So then God calls this guy out of the city and he puts him in the back of a desert somewhere for a time. Then he calls him back into the city to get God's people out of the city. You know the story. So really the first city that the chosen people of God built was for Pharaoh, right? And so a lot of those things that they learned building that city was carried forward into some of the other cities that they later inhabited. They got corrupted. Because see, the city of man is made with the hands of men. It's not made with the hands and mind of God, with his design. Things that are done strictly for the glory of man receive no respect from God, and they will certainly not last into eternity. The city of man represents man's self-reliance and his opposition to God. The city, in many ways, becomes the result of man's fleeing the presence of God. Man ceases his wanderings in the city. He settles in the city. The city offers him a sense of security. When we talk about city, we're talking about the scope of the city, what it means, okay, in terms of nations and organizations of men. The city offers him a sense of security, sense of relief. He finds communion there with others that then leads him not to need the communion with God. It's a place where he can pursue his own things, things that he thinks will make him happy. It's a place where he can invent and create himself to make a name for himself, like the Bible said. The city is a place where man can go to hide. But what man doesn't realize is the man's city only offers slavery. There's no freedom. The freedom offered by man's city is a farce. Ironically, though, man sees its cities, it sees what it's built as its greatest triumph. Man's greatest triumph is in the city. The greatest work of man's hands and minds to create a structure of society. And the Bible tells us in the book of Revelation that all the cities of man will fall in a moment. Revelation 16, verse 9. Now the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon was remembered before God to give her, to pour out on her the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. All that work gone. And yet this is where man builds and builds and builds. It's where he exercises power. It's where he finds security. It's where he creates creature comforts that suit his every whim to make him forget the reality of his situation and his utter reliance on God. You see, the city is where man thinks he can be king. But in fact, he's nothing more than a slave. The city of man represents a perversion and a counterfeit of what God had intended from the very beginning. We see right here, the man city is cursed. Its end is predetermined right here. Throughout the Bible, when we see God speaking to the city, to the structure of what man's built in the society, we see a message of great condemnation over and over. We see a message of judgment. We never see God make a covenant with a city, with a man city, with this structure. He makes covenant with man. But he doesn't make covenant with the city of man. The Bible is largely a story of two cities, Babylon and Jerusalem. And all through, you see this back and forth conflict between Babylon and Jerusalem. And we're told to come out of Babylon, to come out of all of those ways, all of these things that man builds to make a name. Okay? We are to desire Jerusalem with a righteous king, a pure language, and a realization and understanding that that king is sovereign. All right. So we looked at where this took place. We looked at who God is dealing with and why he had to do it. So as we look at all this, what does it mean to us now? We know what it means for us in the future. Pure language is restored. We get a new Jerusalem, God's city. The man's cities are destroyed. But what about today? Well, the Bible says that we're living in Babylon today. We're living in Babel. Guys, the city has been built. And it's been duplicated, in my view, all over the world. So where's the tower? Well, we've got all sorts of them. They're all over the place. The tower represented their thinking that they wouldn't need God, that they could do whatever they wanted. If heaven is where rulership is, well, then we'll just build our own. We'll rule ourselves. Aren't we trying to do that? Rule ourselves. That's the tower. Our governments are structured that way, devised by men instead of being led by God. The attitude of the tower is represented in things like abortion laws. and sexual orientation, like I've already said. We have corporations and insurance companies and, of course, science that we can all, of course, depend on for security and truth and our well-being. We have our towers of institutions to govern us. Who needs God? After all, whatever we propose to do, surely we can accomplish it on our own, right? We're even trying to fix the language problem we have, for the most part. Even though English is the largest and most widely spoken language around the world, we're far from an English-only world. But we don't even need to get there. Because the Tower of Babel problem of the confusion of languages is pretty much fixed today. Major companies make a large share of their money outside their home country in our global economy. And so what happens? They have to quickly learn what the Japanese, the French, Italians, the Germans, you know, what they like and what they will buy. Not just the English-speaking ones. So they adapt. They adapt products, they adapt manuals. For, say, the Japanese market, it might cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. But to not go there, they'd lose way more than that, right? And so we have all these companies that have sprung up in the last 10, 20 years that specialize in helping corporations go global and deal with the language problem. These companies have been growing at 10, 20, 30, 50 times growth every year, year after year. I'm seeing it in my business. I've already got people that speak Dutch, French, and Spanish. I get emails from them routinely all week long. It takes me 2 seconds. Copy, go to Google Translate, paste. A second later, it's in English. And I use it all the time, almost every day. There's a device out now that you can go travel anywhere in the world. And you can want to come up and ask somebody something, you ask them, turn it to them, and it speaks it in their language, and back and forth you go. Completely, language is not a barrier. At Babel, God could see that man's plan and approach would soon repeat the mindset before the flood, when every intent of the heart was evil continually. And then again, God saw that indeed the people are one and they have one language and this is what they're going to do. So, you know, they were heading right back to the old ways. We're told that in the end, yet future for us, man will be right back there again. Remember, if it wasn't for God intervening, no flesh on earth would be saved, though I. So that's where it's going. And you know, the introduction of these different languages slowed that down. It served to divide humanity. But now, in our frenzied information age, we are just running headlong into the same thing, into our own demise. Daniel recorded in chapter 12, verse 4, that at the end days, people, the knowledge would increase, and people would run to and fro. Now the world can plunge on right into a spiral of greed and violence, with the complications of language overcome. The fullness of the city will come. A global economy, global power, global government, all designed to supposedly give human beings the same things they wanted in Babylon. Security, a name, independence from God, so they could rule themselves and set their own laws and standards. Those towers are going up all around us, folks. And in my view, the message to us from God, to anyone with ears to hear and eyes to see, is to come out of Babel. Come out of Babylon. Come out of the man city. We need to have our eyes fixed firmly on the kingdom of God, on Jerusalem, on God's ways, on God's society, and be building and be involved in what God is doing and step out of the city. Because, guys, the fullness of the city on this earth, of man's city, is coming in all its supposed splendor, and we must not get drawn into its ways. Because just like Babel, it won't last. Revelation 18, 2-3. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. That's the city. Is that your dwelling place? It says, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Guys, the promise of the man city is empty and it's futile. And it is why we are admonished to come out of her, God says, and be ye separate. Amen?